good?
All right.
If I could have your attention, we're going to start our program here. All right, we're going to start our final program for California in the World Ocean, number 10. I'm Brian Baird. If you don't know me by now, I'm the California Assistant Secretary for Ocean and Coastal Policy. I want to thank you all for coming to this conference. I think we're going to finish strong with a fantastic panel that we've assembled for you this afternoon. Now, I'm going to introduce our panelists in a minute. I'm going to make a few opening remarks first. We ended up with over 800 people at this conference from all over California, but we also had 17 other states at this conference and people from many faraway places. We had people from, as you know, Caravas, Solomon Islands, Fiji, Germany, Austria, Australia, Canada, Poland, England, and the Netherlands, which is pretty exciting for a state conference. And we should all be proud of drawing people to this state to help us with this conference. It's a labor of love for many, many people. There's a lot of people who obviously are here and spoke, and you're the body of the conference. We also had a lot of people who helped us with our committees. You can imagine we had 64 openings for plenary sessions. We received 74 plenary proposals and then an additional 200 individual presentation proposals. So we had our work cut out for us because they were all great, but we had to say no to some people, which was kind of hard. I think we've addressed a lot of ocean management and protection issues at this conference, and what's great is it's been at the international level, the national level, regional, state, and local levels. As you know, we've videotaped these sessions, and one thing about this is all of us have seen about 1/7 of this conference because we've had 7 concurrent sessions going. But we have videotaped everything, and I want to thank Marla Morrissey with the Morrissey Family Trust Fund because they came up with $15,000 to make that happen. So now for you true wonks, you can gather the entire family, spend endless happy hours watching the entire conference. It's 125 hours. You can sit there for 5 solid days, 24 hours a day, in ocean and coastal bliss. But, all kidding aside, use this as a resource. This is a video library for all of you. And after 2006, I used it. I had to go speak at conferences or testify at hearings, and I went and watched what that person sitting next to me said at California and World Ocean 2006, and you can do the same thing. On photography, we have Alan Lott, my friend, right here, and he's our photographer, and he has photographed every single session in this conference. So we're going to try to make that available through our website, and we're going to figure out, I don't know what we're going to do because he took a lot of pictures, but we'll figure that out. Some observations. How do you capture the many topics and issues that we discussed with 64 concurrent sessions? But I believe we learned that California does lead in many areas, but ocean leadership occurs throughout this nation and some of the most remote corners of the globe. President Tong from Caravas came here, and he made a compelling case. How more compelling could we have the case for dealing with climate change and for his absolutely visionary efforts at protecting the largest marine protected area on Earth? I mean, it was absolutely, I think it moved all of us. I heard about it for days throughout this entire conference. And he didn't limit his concerns to his country, to his republic. He called on all of us to come together on the Pacific 2020 challenge. He said, let's reach across the Pacific and try to make things happen. And I hope we can all help him with that. Certainly, Governor Schwarzenegger has made that commitment. We're going to try and do what we can to help. Our West Coast Governor's Agreement and other regional partnerships throughout this nation are a start to that kind of big thinking. Last night, we also heard from Congressman Sam Farr and NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco, and I think they set forth some real challenges on what we're trying to do at the national level, and that's exciting. Some California observations. Seafloor mapping. We're unlocking the mysteries of the seafloor right now. We're seeing things that have never been seen before by our ancestors, and we're using it. And what was so fun for me, I mean, I was out on a run one day, and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if John Hankey would come here and do this visualization up and down the coast and out to the islands and all these things, which he did. And I think we need that kind of visualization to turn people on to what we're trying to do. And I should mention, we've got our efforts here in California, and Oregon and Washington, as part of the West Coast Governor's Agreement, are working on similar kinds of mapping. On climate change, our efforts with AB 32 to address sea level rise, sea temperature change, and ocean acidification are driving state, national, and international actions right now. We heard ample evidence at this conference that we can't stop that. And I think you heard the Cabinet Secretary, Lester Snow, make his feelings quite well known on that regard. I hope all of you are going to continue to support actions necessary to deal with climate change. It's critical. Marine protected areas. We are soon going to have a network of marine protected areas off 1,100 miles of coast. Who would have thought we'd be saying that 10 years ago? That's just absolutely amazing. We're delighted with that. On new technologies, this summer we became the first state in this nation to use genetic methods to monitor beach water quality. What does that mean? That means that we can have same-day health advisories now, where it always took 2 to 3 days to get those advisories. So up until now, you thought, oh, damn, I shouldn't have gone out in the water 3 days ago. Now you can know within hours. It's very, very exciting. Also with technology, we've got a national network of ocean observation systems around the country providing substantial benefits for this nation. And I think one of the reasons is communication. It took a while, in my view, for the observations community to stop talking about the size of the antennas and to start talking about how this stuff is used out in the field and the kind of benefits for this nation. And I think that's beginning to pay off. Marine spatial planning. We've been engaged in this in California for years. I don't think it's been necessarily called marine spatial planning, but I think we've been doing it. I don't think we've been doing it in the same way that's currently envisioned. So now we're learning from other states that are doing more formal processes and more comprehensive processes, and that's a very, very good thing. So we're ready to take the next steps in California and through the West Coast Governor's Agreement to embrace this concept of marine spatial planning and to work hard to make it happen. There are a lot of sessions here on that topic. Marine debris. Maybe someday we'll get plastic bags out of our ocean waters for good. That's certainly something that I believe we're making progress. I think we've done a lot in California, a lot of local government-generated issues and processes. I wish we'd pass this legislation. Maybe there's still time this year in a special session. But if not, we just continue to pound on this and make something happen. Science. Science is driving management like never before with new partnerships dealing with government and academia and industry and NGOs. Here in California, many of those efforts are led by our California Ocean Science Trust. Other states have other sorts of organizations like that. We also have the California Sea Grant Program, and I know there's a few of the students who made it in here, I don't know, from the various sessions. I heard a little clapping there. Oh, there we go. All right. And by the way, we've benefited, I mean, there's a ton of Sea Grant fellows in this room, so if anybody doubts the impact of the Sea Grant program, that should give, in fact, raise your hand if you're an ex-Sea Grant fellow.
Or current,
yeah. Well, there's a lot more I could say about this conference, but, you know, I could go on and on. Those who know me know I could go on and on. But finally, before we move on with our panel, let me once again thank our sponsors, our organizers, all our partners in this event. I mean, they've done an absolutely terrific service for us all. I think it's been a fantastic thing. A few individuals, Dr. Amber Mace, who has been sort of my partner in crime on this, and just for her absolutely outstanding work on this, and for really, more importantly, her dedication to this field of ocean and coastal management. So thank you, Amber. Also, Chris Potter, he's right here, and Aaron McKell. I don't know if Aaron is here somewhere, back there. Thank you both for all that you've done. And Chris, you've just stepped up to the plate on this like never before. So thank you. And then our motley crew over here, AGP Video, who've just been outstanding. They've been at so many of our ocean events up and down the coast. Everywhere we do an ocean event, these guys are sitting over there trying to make all this stuff work for us. So thank you so much for all your good work. Just real quickly, I'm going to mention by name our California State University conference planners, Priscilla Gandy, who you've seen up and down this place. She has, there's been no task that she has not taken on for us. She has just made this thing work. Her staff, Heather Williams, Barbara Lowell, Jacqueline Jenkins, Tommy Munson, Laura Cortez, Donna Danzigers, and Cheryl Alsogoff. I'm probably not doing well on some of these names, and Susan Gonzalez. But they have all done a spectacular job keeping this thing happen. I think it's been on time, it's been on budget, it just has worked. So anyway, thanks to them. All right, now let's move on to our panel, to the event here. As I said, I think we've assembled a wonderful group for this final session. In California and elsewhere, we're increasingly using public-private partnerships. I mean, we've got a huge budget deficit in this state. I think that's obviously something that's happening throughout the United States. We have to do more with less. We have to figure out better ways, more efficient ways of doing things. And I think these public-private partnerships have been key to that. Here in California, issues like the Marine Life Protection Act, our work on marine spatial planning, both now and hopefully in the future, our science integration efforts, our regional governance have all been assisted by the technical and the financial support from philanthropic interests and other partners. I think it's a wave of the future. I mean, I can just tell you that, for example, the Marine Life Protection Act, that announcement they just made, we wouldn't be making that announcement without public-private partnerships, period. So they're really, really critical. So we have an A team here today. I mean, this is such a fantastic panel. I'm just really, really excited to have these people here. So I'm going to introduce all of them now, and then we'll start with the first panelist. First is David Rockefeller. And I just reminded David, I met him at the first meeting of the Pew Oceans Commission at the Willard Hotel after I gave this presentation in this packed room with flashing cameras, and I was scared to death, quite frankly. He was really a fantastic person to talk to and very, very engaged. And he's a director and former chairman of the Rockefeller and Company and an active participant in the nonprofit arena, especially in the areas of environment, philanthropy, arts, and public education. He's past chair of the National Park Foundation, reporting at the time directly, or I guess at that time, to the Secretary of the Interior. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a trustee to the Rockefeller Foundation. And he was, as I mentioned, a member of the really groundbreaking Pew Oceans Commission. He's created the organization Sailors for the Sea, which I assume we're going to hear a little bit about today. And he's a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School. And moving, to Mike Sutton over here. Mike is the vice president of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, where he directs the Center for the Future of the Oceans. And he's no stranger to California and World Ocean Conferences and many of the things we do here. 2007 and 2009, he was appointed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger as a member of the California Fish and Game Commission, and we're all real pleased with that, I can tell you. He's a teacher, and he's an author, and he serves on a number of other boards and commissions. This is my favorite part. In his early career, Mr. Sutton served as a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which I think is very cool, and a park ranger with the National Park Service in Yosemite, Yellowstone, Biscayne, and the Virgin Islands National Parks, and the Death Valley National Monument. What are you doing here? That's just terrific. What a background. And in 1992, he received a law degree from George Washington University's National Law Center in Washington, D.C. And we have Steve McCormick, who is president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, as you know, a major philanthropic organization. His work with this foundation is dedicated to providing positive outcomes for future generations with a significant emphasis on environmental work. Prior to joining the foundation 3 years ago, Steve served as president and CEO of the Nature Conservancy, known to many of us as TNC. Before that, Steve served 16 years as ED of TNC for the California program, and we've all worked with him for many, many years. He achieved a great deal with that organization. He has a law degree from the Hastings School of Law, and I've come to the conclusion that I'm surrounded by a lot of attorneys up here. But anyway, he brings a lot to this field. So with that, I'm going to call on Mr. Rockefeller to start to kick this thing off. We're going to have comments by everyone, and then we can see if there's interest. We'll have some questions from the audience for our speakers. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Brian. It's a great recap of a conference that I've only been at for a day. I haven't been able to be here the whole time, but it really has been wonderful and a great education for me. I thank all of my teachers here in the room. I know more about wave and wind energy, marine spatial planning, ocean literacy, and environmental education curriculum, thanks to you. So I really appreciate that. One of the themes that has been going through my mind is the ways in which scale matters. Scientists know this very well. I think the public is coming to a better understanding that scale matters in the ocean and that what we do matters. But it's taken us a very, very long time. And it's clear to me also that the scale of the number of individuals such as you who know about oceans, care about oceans, and are working to preserve their health, that scale matters a lot. And so one of the things I am going to talk about today is why an organization like Sailors for the Sea, I think, can add immeasurably to the work that you do, because our business is to enlarge the number of non-scientists, non-educators, who know what is happening in the ocean and have a sense that they can do something about it. Not too long ago, people used to get here by rounding Cape Horn. I took a plane, but I did round Cape Horn in January in a sailboat to see what that's like. Some people would say for sailors, which I've been all of my life, that it's kind of the Everest of sailing. And I can say that it was a smaller mountain than Everest the day that we rounded it, but 2 days before it was blowing 100 against us. Luckily, the moment that we went around, it was blowing 20 from behind, and so we set a spinnaker. Went around Cape Horn that way. Not many people have been able to do that. And I went with seven other men. I was the oldest of the group, but it turned out that I had the least sea miles under me, and I think of myself as having a lot, 30,000. But all the others combined for 500,000 sea miles. It was an extraordinary thing. And it took me back to my first days as a sailor, and my parents were very environmentally oriented and took me out sailing, and we'd always get out to the 3-mile line before we threw all our trash in the water. But that's what people did in those days. And the banana peels, the cans, the plastic. Sorry, this is confession time. And then when we were back in the harbor, we caught flounder and pollock and dug for clams, and often in the same harbors into which domestic sewage was pouring, but we weren't making the connection. Now I'm happy to say all that has changed a lot, not only in my own family, but among most of us. And sailors are no longer the polluters that they used to be. And that's a wonderful thing. Brian mentioned my time as a commissioner on the Pew Oceans Commission. And as many of you remember, about that same time, there was a U.S. commission that was getting started. We tried to make it all one commission, and it didn't work. And I just think, imagine if there had been two reports and they came out with diametrically opposed conclusions. We were very nervous about that, but our skillful leadership and theirs worked closely together. And as you all know, those two reports came out very much along the same lines. About 5 years ago, a little more now, I decided that as a result of my loving sailing in the ocean, as a result of my having learned what I did on the Pew Oceans Commission, that I would found a new organization, since I discovered that it didn't exist. I had studied Surfrider and Trout Unlimited and other organizations that drew the recreational users of a resource into conserving that resource. And I discovered that sailors had not been organized in that way. I mean, sailors probably don't like to be organized. That's one of the reasons that they sail. They're getting out there, being liberated from everything on land. But I do think that sailors represent an excellent new cohort of supporters for the oceans. And so I founded Sailors for the Sea, and a few years later, I looked in California to recruit a leader for that project, and Dan Pingaro, Dan, wave your hand, is here in the room, our executive director of Sailors for the Sea, who now lives in Newport, but it's Newport, Rhode Island. And we're delighted that he joined us. And the purpose of the organization is to educate, motivate, and activate recreational boaters, power boaters as well as sailors, but especially sailors, to become stewards of the sea. We affiliate and partner with, Brian was mentioning the importance of partnerships, not only boating groups, but private foundations, academic institutions, museums and aquaria, as well as government entities. And we have already accomplished a lot. I'll just tick off a couple of things that you may not know were activities of ours. The film A Sea Change, focusing on ocean acidification. We were the fiscal agent and a distribution arm for that landmark film on ocean acidification and the importance, of course, of reducing airborne CO2. A project called Around the Americas, a sailing project, first ever that a continuous voyage from Seattle to Seattle, in this case clockwise, by sailboat, went around the American continents. And we refer to the voyage as one island, one ocean. And, of course, the most remarkable part is that they got through the Northwest Passage. They did so last summer, almost exactly a year ago. They were coming out the eastern end of the Northwest Passage. You might say very lucky, but also very ominous that they could do that. And that was part of the point. Sailors for the Sea was a principal sponsor of this circumnavigation of the Americas. The boat was 64 feet steel-hulled, called Ocean Watch. It's now back in Seattle, by the way, if anybody wants a really strong boat with a good history. And they accomplished in 1 year what nobody had ever done before. Of course, they went around the Horn as well. They stopped in more than 50 cities, thinking of education and how and what grabs the attention of young people. More than 50 towns and cities along the way, including, I'm glad to say, San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Monterey, Portland, Port Townsend, and Seattle on the West Coast, where they just completed their journey on the 17th of June of this year. Ocean Watch was not only full of sailors, there were four of them, but educators, scientists, a writer, a photojournalist, so that all the way around, our job, both electronically and person-to-person, was to learn from the people that we were talking to, the fishermen, the children, the teachers, the politicians, et cetera, the scientists in every port, and to bring our learning on to the next port. And all of this will be memorialized about a year from now in a book, and there'll be a film coming out on it. The boat's name is Ocean Watch, and the program was called Around the Americas. Another ongoing activity of Sailors for the Sea, which is coming to the West Coast, I think, Dan, for the first time later this month, is called Clean Regattas. Now, there are more than 12 million recreational boaters in our country, of which more than 2 million, maybe 2.5, are self-described sailors. Some of the latter are community boaters. They're college sailors. Others are day and weekend sailors. Quite a few are avid racers, and a smaller number are offshore sailors. So sailors, in the old days, it used to connote the Navy, but I think today, in many people's minds, it's sort of a narrower band of individuals. But one of the things that we know and we see, and that's very important, I think, for this effort, is that sailors represent everything from a windsurfer to a mega yacht owner. And I think that that demographic is a very, very important thing to note. It's obviously of great interest to the marine industry as well, the boat builders, the marina operators, the marine suppliers, and the marine publishers. At the high end of the spectrum, and this is equally important, of course, you do have sailors with names like Ellison and Disney, Schmidt and Jim Clark, and others who have become supporters of the ocean, and some of them could do even better. And that's a big purpose of Sailors for the Sea, is to recruit the college sailor all the way up to the mega yacht owner and get them in behind these efforts. Clean Regattas is a Sailors for the Sea created program that's already reached 75,000 racing sailors. And the way we do it is we work through yacht clubs and other regatta organizers, where bronze, silver, and gold level certification can be achieved by the good green behavior of the sailors, the race managers, and the sponsoring organizations. The racing venue, as a result, stays cleaner, the boats are greener, and the sailors become wiser about the challenges to ocean health. Clean Regattas. Now, looking into the future, which is a part of our task here today, as you know, it's something like 3 to 5% of all conservation dollars. Steve, I don't know what you cite on this, go to ocean protection, and more than 70% of the surface of the planet. It's a ratio of something like that, the briny part of the planet. And our goal at Sailors for the Sea is to mobilize the active and affluent boating community to become ocean stewards and ocean philanthropists in support of the many wonderful things that you attendees at this conference are already doing in support of ocean health. So to enlarge the size of the philanthropic pie that nourishes the scientists, educators, and activists among you, modeled, as I said, on organizations like Surfrider and Trout Unlimited. A program that's in the thinking stage and that we'd love to have, Dan and I would love to have your input on, is something called Certified Sea Friendly. As part of our envisioning the future, Sailors for the Sea hopes to take the lead in moving the marine industry toward a voluntary program of LEEDs-like standards that would enhance product value while increasing consumer confidence in the relative environmental benefits of a product A that's greener than product X. So stay tuned. Certified Sea Friendly is a program in development, as I said, and we're seeking good partners. A final word about my own view of the ocean's future. I do believe that, as I said at the beginning, as absolutely horrible as recent large-scale ocean-related disasters have been, whether from Katrina to the BP oil spill, from closed wild fisheries to infected fish farms, from disappearing ice to rising sea temperatures, that these very dramatic and well-reported ocean events have finally convinced the American people that the oceans are vital to human survival, they need our help, and that there are things, this is so important, that each of us can do to make a difference. But we need to keep up the drumbeat, obviously, in conferences like that, like this, do that, to encourage the public and private investors to care about the place that feeds us, warms us, cools us, brings us rain, and gives us so much pleasure. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David. Appreciate those comments. Let's move on to Mike Sutton.
Thank you, Brian. Well, it's always a pleasure to share the podium with a couple of other attorneys. I know how much you all appreciate that. But it's even a greater pleasure to share the podium with these two environmental heroes. These are two guys that I've respected over the years. David Rockefeller from the first family of conservation in the United States, the family that gave us Grand Teton National Park, Virgin Islands National Park, and now Sailors for the Sea is a terrific addition. Steve McCormick, who not only led the Nature Conservancy, but perhaps more importantly for us here, founded, is one of the founders of the Resources Legacy Fund and Resources Law Group here in California, arguably one of the most effective forces for conservation both on land and in the water here in California. So our subject today is about investing in the future of the oceans, and it's one that I'm excited about. Because I think there are some new trends in ocean conservation that are really promising. And if it's one thing I've learned over the years, without some level of financial investment, nothing ever happens in our business. You know, I spent 6 years once upon a time at the Packard Foundation, during which time I had my fingers on the purse strings of lots of grant money, at least before the last recession hit. And during that time, you know, all my phone calls got returned immediately. My jokes were all really funny. People, I concluded that either I was really wise and sage and funny, or that I was able to make investments that was a really powerful motivator. And so, of course, there are many different kinds of investments that we've heard about those this week. We can invest in ocean exploitation and ocean destruction, and we've done plenty of that over the years. But of course, not all those investments have proven sustainable or even durable. Of declining fisheries and so forth. Or we can make investments in the conservation, the protection of our oceans and coasts. And the reason that matters is that, you know, Judy Kildow, who was here this week, her National Ocean Economics Program tells us that the ocean economy in California is bigger than the agricultural economy, believe it or not. So if you add it all up, from ecotourism to shipping to all the things we do in the oceans and coasts, our ocean economy is very significant. But I don't want to talk today. You've heard plenty about how we've invested in ocean destruction, ocean pollution, ocean exploitation, ocean depletion. We're good at that. What we're not good at is investing in protection of our oceans. But there are some promising stories out there that I want to share with you today because I'm excited about them. The first and foremost investor in our oceans, of course, is the government. The governments, state and federal governments, spend billions of dollars every year caring for our oceans. We owe them a great deal of thanks. The government employees who are here, Sam Farr spoke at the dinner last night. Congressman Farr is our congressman, I'm proud to say, on the Central Coast where I live in Monterey. He is also a member of the House Appropriations Committee. And so if you want money to do something in the government, you have to talk to Sam or one of his counterparts in the Senate and the House. The federal government can't do anything without a budget, as we're finding out here in California, and they won't have a budget to spend without the Appropriations Committee. So Sam has done tremendous amounts for the oceans just by his work on the Appropriations Committee alone, aside from all the other things that he's done as a legislator. Of course, those of you who were here earlier this week for the California Ocean Protection Council meeting know how much the state does as well as the federal government. I shouldn't have to remind you how challenging the state's job is these days with budget cuts, budget crises, furloughs, IOUs instead of paychecks. It's partly for these reasons that I've always felt that we rely on governments at our peril to save the oceans. It's going to take more than governments. Governments can't do this by themselves. We have relied for too long on public policy to save the oceans. We need to open whole new fronts in the fight to save the oceans, and thankfully we are. One of those, of course, brings me to the second major investor in ocean protection, and that's the private philanthropy, private foundations. We have a long tradition of philanthropy in this country, and it's not just because of the inheritance tax, but because our people have the vision to see that governments need help in the fight to protect our oceans. And Americans have always been willing to stand up and be counted for something as important as that. So for over the years, you've seen private foundations like the Moore Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and lots of others provided billions of dollars for ocean exploration, research, advocacy, field work, helps us protect and understand our marine environment. I guess one of the big advantages I see at private foundations, of course, is that they don't, and individual donors, is they're not constrained like the government. The government's not going to fund your advocacy program, but a private donor will and has and do. Governments can't fund a lot of things. Governments aren't going to take the kinds of risks that private funders can. And that makes the private investors very important. Now, sometimes, as Brian mentioned, these two investors get together. And that's where it gets really interesting. They do things together because they can accomplish a lot more together than working separately. Those are called public-private partnerships, and we have some classic examples of them right here in California. An invaluable tool for conservation. The Cargill salt ponds around San Francisco Bay is one of the leading examples that Steve at the Moore Foundation was involved in. That was a $100 million project to acquire and ultimately restore the salt ponds in the South Bay, owned by Cargill. That took a combination of federal money, state money, and private foundation, a coalition of foundations, to put together that much money. $100 million is just the acquisition cost. The restoration of those wetlands is going to cost more than $1 billion, because it's not as simple as just, you know, breaching the levees and letting nature take over. So when that kind of money is involved, the government doesn't have enough. Even a private foundation as big as Packard or Moore doesn't have enough. You've got to work together. The other great example we have here that I have the scar tissue from is the Marine Life Protection Act and the initiative that that's underway now to create a statewide network of marine reserves in California, the largest in the nation. That, as Brian said, would not have been possible had it not been that for private foundations that stepped up and helped the state do it right. And that's still a work in progress. Now, in addition to governments and the nonprofit sector, there's a sort of a new investor in town these days in oceans, which I find really exciting, and that's the business community itself, the for-profit sector. You know, we used to see businesses, when I started in the world of conservation, we all saw businesses as the opposition. You know, the evil corporate entities that were more interested in depleting the ocean and drilling for oil and gas and polluting and so forth. But these days, we often partner with businesses for the benefit of conservation, to find new approaches to protect our oceans and coasts. Increasingly, we're seeing businesses invest in ocean conservation directly. Conservation community, you know, we've often, as the panel can witness, we've mostly hired scientists and lawyers in the past at our conservation groups. I spent 10 years at World Wildlife Fund. We had a bunch of scientists and lawyers there. You know, the scientists had credibility but didn't know what to do with it. The lawyers had no credibility, but they had the tactical ability. So you put them together, it was very effective. Well, there's a third degree now that we are increasingly bringing to bear, and that is the Master of Business Administration, the MBA. We're starting to hire more people with business and finance backgrounds who speak the language of business and can engage businesses in and private capital investment in conservation. Paul Hawken, the author of The Ecology of Commerce back in the 90s, taught us that the only force really powerful enough to reverse the unsustainable use of natural resources is commerce itself. And we have founded a number of programs on that. Let me give you a couple of examples. 15 years ago in Europe, I was involved in one of the first business environment partnerships for sustainable seafood. I was at World Wildlife Fund, the biggest conservation organization in the world. We partnered with the biggest seafood buyer in the world, Unilever Corporation, huge transnational, Anglo-Dutch transnational. And I asked him for £1 million sterling to start a new organization to safeguard ocean fisheries called the Marine Stewardship Council. And they looked at me like I was nuts. You know, I said, look, we'll put up £1 million sterling from World Wildlife Fund. We want you to put up £1 million sterling to help fix what's wrong with our oceans. And I'll never forget, I went to a Unilever board meeting in Rotterdam. Here are a bunch of conservative Dutch businessmen and their English counterparts. And I stood up and explained what we had in mind. We're going to set up an eco-labeling outfit to be the good housekeeping seal of approval for sustainable seafood. And they looked at me like I was crazy, and one of them said, you know, this is nuts. It's going to cost us millions of pounds to do this. And then the old chairman of Unilever, great Dutch guy, got up and said, you know, you're right, but not doing this is going to cost us more. And that was the bottom line. We harnessed the enlightened self-interest of businesses that depend on natural resources. Overfishing's bad for business. It's a business risk that they just as soon do without. And they had just been through something called the mad cow crisis, where they'd lost 60 billion pounds sterling. And so £1 million sterling was pocket change for them to ensure the future of the oceans and the future of their fisheries. So that's one example. We have lots of examples here in California. The Central Coast Groundfish Project of the Nature Conservancy, where TNC went in and bought trawl permits from the fishermen, turned them into hook and line fishing permits, leased them back into the fishery. That resulted in fishermen and enviros going together to the government and winning 3.8 million acre no trawl zone right off the coast here in California. The Sea Change Investment Fund, I'm on the board of the first environmental venture capital fund for sustainable seafood. It's called the Sea Change Investment Fund. It's based here in San Francisco. It's a small fund, $20 million. That's a drop in the bucket compared to these gigantic high-tech VC funds. But guess what? Seafood is a small industry compared to high-tech, so you don't need a big fund. $20 million, it's putting our money where our mouths have been, basically, is what that's about. We are now able to invest in companies that want to do it right, that want to sell sustainable seafood instead of any old seafood. I'm enormously encouraged by the rise of restaurants founded on sustainability. Tataki Sushi here in San Francisco, Bamboo Sushi in Portland, Hook Restaurant in Washington, D.C. These are all founded by young, up-and-coming entrepreneurs who are marketing sustainability to their clients, and that's really an encouraging example. There are lots of other examples of how we are harnessing the power of private investment for conservation, catch shares in fisheries, the California Fisheries Fund, and so forth. But we don't have time to go into them all today. I want to end by talking about probably the most important investor of all in conservation, and that is the individual investor. You know, it doesn't matter what governments do or the private sector does. You and I can invest in conservation every day. Probably the most popular thing we have ever done at the Monterey Bay Aquarium for our constituents, our visitors, and our members and so forth, is the Seafood Watch program. And I brought cards for every one of you, up-to-date cards. How many of you carry this card or the iPhone application anyway? Good. That's great. Well, I brought you an up-to-date card because it changes periodically. This is the a red-green-yellow simple guide to sustainable seafood that you can exercise every day, and you can vote with your wallet at your favorite restaurant or at your Safeway or Whole Foods or your retail establishment. This is a whole new front in the fight to save the ocean because it gives people something they can do in their own lives every day to make a difference. People love that. That's why recycling is so powerful. They don't think that writing their politicians or, you know, joining environmental groups works very well. Most people would rather do something themselves to make a difference. Single-use plastic bags. Sure, we suffered a setback this legislative session when the legislature failed to pass AB 1998, the ban on single-use plastic bags. That doesn't mean that we're powerless. We can ban plastic bags in our own lives, and that's easy. We'll get to it in official action. It's only a matter of time. So many municipalities have already done that in California. The legislature's got to follow suit sooner or later. I have confidence in that. And finally, of course, you can vote with your vote. As Lester said the other day, Proposition 21 is a great example of how we can invest in the future of our oceans directly. Proposition 21, the increase in vehicle license fees, $20 million of those dollars. This is not going to just fund state parks. $20 million a year would go to fund ocean conservation and marine protected areas in perpetuity. So if you care about the oceans, you might want to think about supporting Prop 21. Thank you for all you do on behalf of the oceans. Go out and keep up the good work and make use of these Seafood Watch cards.
Mike, thank you very much, and I think you noticed they had the Seafood Watch stamp on our menus last night.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, well, you've had a lot of impact.
Brian was afraid that if he served Chilean sea bass, you might hear about it from Sylvia and others.
I was terrified, actually. All right, let's move on to Steve McCormick.
Thanks, Brian. I'm just going to stand because I want you to see me. As the last guy on the last panel on the last day of a week-long conference, I either got to observe that this is impressive you're here or it's really pathetic because it's a beautiful day outside. So if you start wandering out, I'll understand why. Years ago, I was the last speaker at a huge conference that the Bureau of Land Management put on in Reno for about 1,000 people from the mining industry. And all the speakers were from the mining industry but me, and I was literally the last person. And the next day I was in line at the breakfast buffet, and I heard these two guys. It was so huge they couldn't tell who was at the podium. So I heard one guy said, "Did you go to that last talk?" I said, "No." And the first guy said, "I don't know, I guess they just figured they needed some conversationist here." Conversationist. Oh, we meant conservationist. So I was the... Very humbling. So I'm going to spare you, and I'm going to be really brief. It's hard to add much wisdom at the end of a long conference like this that has been attended by and informed by so many active participants like yourselves. So I'm just going to share some, I'll say, high-level observations of where I see the kind of state of play in the conservation field, because I'm very, very excited. I've been working in conservation for about 30 years, and I think we're really at the threshold of a whole new philosophy for conservation, and one that I think offers very exciting possibilities that we only could barely imagine 30 years ago. And that philosophy is, frankly, moving from the driving ethos that I had at the beginning of my career, for most of my career, which was to focus on protected areas and species conservation. And in the last 10 years or so, and this is certainly not an immediate change, but I'd say a real shift in the ground. We're seeing the movement towards the need to embrace the human dimension in our work. And frankly, the philosophy of protected areas was built around the notion of saving, preserving, protecting, setting aside, which all suggested that we were taking it away from people. And frankly, in the wealthy countries of the world, that is very appealing. But as I traveled around developing countries and used that kind of language and talked in those terms, I realized it was enormously off-putting and actually sounded very confiscatory and very imposed. The ocean environments are perhaps the best systems to demonstrate this new philosophy, and it's very encouraging to see the movement in that direction and how those themes have animated this conference. So things like marine spatial planning, I mean, that alone suggests something beyond and more complex than marine protected areas alone. The dramatic and very encouraging breakthroughs in the legislation in Massachusetts, the developing and emerging approaches in other states, the fact that we actually have a national ocean policy that may blossom and flourish along those lines is enormously encouraging. Catch shares. I mean, even the notion of share is a more accepting notion of the human element in the equation. And then the still developing and still quite theoretical concept of ecosystem services. I have been so struck by the first declaration of the findings from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment done by 1,300 of the world's preeminent academic scientists, originally intended to be an assessment of the status of biodiversity. And to their credit, they said, you know, biodiversity, it's kind of, maybe that's a little bit of a thud. Maybe that is too academic. And they turned it into an assessment of ecosystems. And the first finding is that everyone in the world is dependent upon nature and ecosystem services to provide the conditions for a safe, healthy, decent life. I mean, that is an extraordinarily unequivocal, profoundly important statement from 1,300 of the world's academic scientists. And implicit in that statement is how important conservation is, not just for nature's sake, and I still believe very much that that is important, but for human well-being. And again, the ocean environment is a perfect opportunity, and I think we and you all are at a stage where we can begin proving out what are still highly theoretical concepts, and starting to see that happen already. Now, easier said than done, obviously, and it's going to require some very difficult, challenging changes in the way we think and work, because these are wicked problems, and they don't lend themselves to quick fixes or easy solutions. First of all, in my career, I've talked so frequently about partnerships, public-private partnerships, and indeed have seen quite a few that are successful and see more and more that are very encouraging. Typically, those partnerships are among kind of the like-minded, and I'd say, you know, in most cases, they are alignments and not real partnerships. A real partnership means you give up some control for the greater good of an outcome. And I think we're going to have more and more true alliances and partnerships with those who use ocean resources. I know we're all conservationists, and we have a belief in the importance of natural resources. We don't derive our livelihoods, for the most part, every day from ocean resources. And those are the alliances we really have to make. Policymakers are in the position all the time of hearing from individual interest groups, and then they have to sort of sort through and come up with either a compromise or just sidestep the issue altogether. When organizations or individuals from very different points of view, and often in the past conflicting points of view, can align around a shared vision of success, that makes it really easy for a policymaker. Now, that's a lot harder to do than just simply going in and advocating for a particular interest. It's going to require trade-offs, real trade-offs. And it will mean in many cases not 100% conservation. So how much are we willing to trade off to get more widespread conservation, but perhaps at less than what we would consider perfect? It's going to require more understanding of how humans do work in the communities and sectors that are deriving livelihoods and well-being from natural resources. We've gotten pretty good about the natural sciences, and we're pretty well informed on the biological dimensions of the resources we work in, not so much on the very messy, complex, unpredictable human dimensions of those landscapes. We're going to have to learn those better. And it's going to require more willingness to experiment, to design based on best information, but less than perfect, to go out and try, again, with alliances that are somewhat atypical, to be willing to accept things that don't work and then learn and adapt and do that in real time and real fast. And that's something that, frankly, most NGOs have a hard time with. So I do think that we are on the very, very encouraging threshold of a extraordinarily powerful new philosophy for conservation. And I see it emerging most encouragingly and most impressively in the marine sector. So this conference, as I look through the various workshops, suggests that there's already a kind of a head start. And as the other speakers have said, insufficient funding has really gone into ocean conservation, but funders are increasingly interested in marine conservation, not, again, just for nature's sake, but for what it offers for human well-being. And we're beginning to see some funders who traditionally have said they don't support conservation, appreciate conservation because, as the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment so boldly asserted, it is an imperative for human well-being. So, on behalf of the Moore Foundation and my colleagues here, Emily Goodwin, and I saw Megan Calcari here earlier as well, thank you, our grantees particularly, and our partners especially, but all of you who work so hard in this field, what you are doing is really creating, say, the new paradigm, if you will, for conservation in the 21st century. So in 4 years, we'll look forward to what will be a step change in results from the outcomes of this conference. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. We're at about 1:45, but I'd like to see if people have some questions. It's a great opportunity to talk to some real leaders in this field of public-private partnerships. Do we have anything that anyone would like to ask? Okay, over here. Yes.
So, Mr. Rockefeller,
we got a microphone so that we'll get this recorded.
I hope it's worthy of that. I work for the city of San Francisco, and we're very much hoping that a certain regatta will come to our shores, since you mentioned Mr. Ellison. And I'm just wondering or offering that if it does come and if you can help us, that we'd really like to test out your clean regatta standards and was wondering what it would take to make it at that highest level here in San Francisco.
Wonderful. Wonderful. We'd be delighted to work with you on that. I'm working behind the scenes with one of the lawyers on the Oracle team, and we'd be delighted to talk to you about that. You can also look at the Sailors for the Sea website, which would give you that information, but let's talk, and Dan Pingaro over here would be delighted. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Great question. Over here.
Hi, I'm Don Martin with SeaWeb, and it's a great pleasure to be here with this wonderful community, and thank you all for your support and for gathering us. We've heard a lot today about, or all week, about the problems, and today heard a lot about the solutions. I wonder if you all could share with us sort of your perception of what the missing links are. Where is the biggest gap that you see for us as a community to try to focus our energy and resources to make sure that we do end up with a healthy and sustainable ocean ecosystem for the next generation? Thank you.
Don, I'm glad you asked that question, because Steve alluded, I think, to the part of the answer. As we refocus our effort and reframe our work from focusing on things like biodiversity conservation towards human well-being, I think we're going to have to refocus more than just the framing of our work. One of the things that I so often see in our community, the conservation community, is that we allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. And in working with business and working with framing our work in terms of human well-being, I don't think we can afford to do that, because change often comes in incrementally. And if we insist on perfection among the business community and human communities and so forth, or nothing, then I think our work will be self-defeating. So I would encourage us to not only reframe how we think about our work, but how we go about our work.
David.
I'd just add quickly to that, and it's a very important question, that I think all of us, and I hear lots of progress during this conference, need to be careful about how we speak, and careful that we also listen well, and that's picking up from really what Steve was saying. And on the speaking side, that when we're in non-specialist communities, that we speak in a way that is clear and understandable and connects. And on the listening side, that we really listen to the other points of view, and I thought, Steve, what you said really underscored that. So just those two. Speak well, listen well.
Just make an observation. Wouldn't it be interesting to pursue something called the Marine Life and Jobs Protection Act? I mean, just, you have to think, how do you frame something in terms that get people to buy into your vision? And how do you create a shared vision that really is achievable? And so if I see a gap, that's the gap I have seen.
There's a, funny you mentioned that, Steve. There is a bill in the U.S. Congress right now called the Coastal Jobs Creation Act, which is both about jobs and conservation. So the Senate has a week left, I think, to pass it, but we'll see.
I think, Mike, you also mentioned a great example. I love the Morro Bay example, where a group came in, worked with the fishermen, looked at the resource, came up with a different fishing technique. And it worked. People are making money, and the environment's benefiting. I mean, that's the kind of thing we ought to be doing, I think. Others, we've got one right here.
Yeah, I'm Doug Hammerstrom, mayor of Fort Bragg, and have a lot of those people who make their living in the ocean in our community. And I think I was delighted to hear the comments of the last speaker, and I think that's in part why I'm involved in ocean issues myself, is trying to find that conversation where ocean health and users of the ocean work together. And I would announce that in the MLPA process, the North Coast Regional Stakeholders Group, for the first time in any region in California, came to a consensus decision on an array of protected areas, and that was both conservationists and resource extractors. And so I think the resource extractors in our community are primed to have the conversation about how we both build jobs and conservation and ocean health in that way. And so I invite all the scientists and all the people thinking about conservation to continue those conversations with our resource users.
Great comment. Any? Okay. Do Tom?
Too contrary, but I've had experience working with stakeholder groups where there are people who basically join basically to destroy what you're trying to do, and that's their intention. And I'm just wondering, with your experience with different partners, is do you find there is such a thing as a bad partner, and how do you identify that person, and how do you deal with it?
Mike, you want to take that?
Thanks a lot, guys. Well, there's no doubt that some stakeholder processes are difficult. The mayor talked about the MLPA. The MLPA is the most elaborate public process I think I have ever been involved in anywhere, and I've been doing this for 20 years. That doesn't mean it's easy. That doesn't mean everybody agrees. I mean, this is the first, as the mayor pointed out, it's the first time that a stakeholder group has arrived at a single recommended proposal for a network of protected areas. Most other stakeholder groups arrived at three or four because they couldn't agree among themselves. It's a rather extraordinary accomplishment that the group on the North Coast came up with a single proposal. But that was very hard fought. And oftentimes, the sausage-making that goes into good public policy is not pretty to watch, but it's really important at the same time, because if you don't, one of the things we've learned the hard way is if government simply goes and draws lines on maps and then takes those maps on the road to show them to people, they'll get shouted out of the room. That's what happened the first two times the MLPA there were attempts made by the state to implement the MLPA. Doing public processes right is hard. It's messy. It's sometimes ugly, but it's also really essential.
Yeah, you make a good point that often participants in a, we'll say, a group process take a strong ideological and unyielding position and aren't willing to budge. Conservationists do that as well as anybody. Are there bad partners? Yeah. Are there bad people? Typically not. My experience has been that once people get to know one another, and again, I'm generalizing, but I have to say that this, for the most part, will work. Once people get to know one another as a person and not as a caricature, they will then create trust and respect and get to a point where they really do a desire to get common ground. I had an experience in Riverside County working on a very contentious issue arising out of the listing of the Coachella Valley fringe-toed lizard as endangered. And it caused the development, the real estate development community there to really come unglued with the consequences. It could threaten to shut down all development. And we had a former county supervisor who we brought together. We had this coalition that just to get the issues on the table and make sure that people were trying to connect with one another as people. And he was really outspoken and very negative. And I talked with a couple of other participants, and we said, you know, what the heck? I mean, he's very influential here. Let's just give this a try. Let's make him chair of the steering committee. Then all of a sudden, he had a stake in the outcome. I mean, he couldn't just sit there and be negative. He had to direct this to a positive conclusion, and he was superb at it because he'd been in public service. So there are no magic solutions, but I'll tell you, my experience has been when people get together and start working together as as sort of colleagues and as friends, it has a far greater chance of reaching a good solution.
One more idea. One something I often do when two stakeholders are at odds intractably, I take them up flying. Not only do they see the area for themselves from a different perspective for the first time, but even if they don't agree necessarily when they come back down, but at least they have a sense of shared survivorship, which is helpful.
That may be a good note, or we have another. Okay, I'd like to make one comment, too. I mean, this whole Marine Life Protection Act, you know, I got in a little bit of trouble a few years back when somebody asked me, what do you think it's controversial? And I said, well, I think it's sort of thermonuclear, actually, and, of course, got it on the front page of the newspaper. But it's amazing what has happened since that time with this process. But it took a lot of investment to bring these stakeholder groups together, to have the science together to make this thing really, I think, impenetrable in terms of people saying that this was some sort of a political decision. And something happened here at this conference, which I found fascinating. Kathy Rehoice-Boyd with the Western States Petroleum Association made a comment about, well, I don't know if everybody's going to like me being up here. And a table over there from the Marine Life Protection Act all said, no, we love you. And I thought, wow, that's kind of a little bit of a change in attitudes about people working together, which was I found fascinating. Okay, we're going to take this as our last question, if we could.
Hi, my name is Susan Allen. I'm with the Pew Environment Group, and I'm lucky enough to be a native Oregonian, and I direct a coalition of folks that represent about 300,000 people who live in Oregon. When I came to the process in 2007, we represented about 40,000 members. And what we've seen in our little tiny bubble of the ocean is exactly what you all are talking about, and I'm really inspired to hear more about it. When we first started, it was absolutely at loggerheads, and although Oregon has embraced a very incremental approach, the bill that we passed in 2009 really set a place at the table for each of the stakeholder groups that include non-fishing industry, and we also have been coordinating with labor. So at this point, right before the final recommendations come in November of this year, I stand with you having an endorsing organization of the Oregon League of Minority Voters and the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Oregon Business Association. And what my question is, how do you bring that all to some sort of end result that really changes the dynamic as you move forward? I think we've begun the conversation. How do you complete it?
You know, I think Steve touched on the answer to that question earlier when he said it's about being invested in the process. Years ago, when I was at World Wildlife Fund, we decided to address the problem of the huge import of wild birds for the pet trade in the United States. The United States used to import millions of dollars of wild birds caught in the wild in other countries, imported into the United States for the pet trade. We don't do that anymore. It's illegal. But to get to that point, to get that law enacted, the law eventually was passed as the Wild Bird Conservation Act of 1996, which bans the import of wild birds for the pet trade. It replaces the birds in the pet trade with captive bred birds. But to get there, we had to build the round table, and we invited all the combatants. Some of these people had been at each other's throats for 30, 40 years. The pet industry, the bird breeders, the zoos, the humane societies, the conservation groups, got them all around the table. And, of course, we were in the middle with the only other things in the middle of the road are the road-killed animals, you know. So you have a lot of scar tissue from doing that, but we kept all of those groups around the table for more than a year while we were drafting that legislation, despite the fact that they really wanted to peel off and write their own bill, and a couple of them did that. And the others who could have killed the bill at any stage by going to their favorite senator stayed at the table because they were invested in the process. And the process was robust enough. They were listened to. Their opinions were taken into account. And that's really critical, to give everybody a voice and a role in the process. If you don't do that, ultimately, or you can't afford to do that, it's ultimately not going to work.
Any other comments? Well, let's have a great round of applause for our fantastic panel here. And with that, we'll conclude this panel and the conference. Thank you all very much.
Good to join you.
Right, thanks.
Thanks, everybody. Steve, nice to see you.
Good to see you.